When I was a young boy, my family used to celebrate Christmas to the nines. I mean, we would really do it up big. And Christmas dinner was always spent at my grandmother's house. And she would put every leaf that she owned in the dining room table and stretch it all the way out almost to the walls, and then would tee off another makeshift table out of plywood and sawhorses that they would disguise with white tablecloths so it looked rather nice, so that we could get the entire extended family around this T-shaped table. And that, you know, the special china came out and the, you know, decorations. They worked for days on this thing. And in the center of this table, my grandmother always made a special cake for Christmas that was in the shape of a lamb. It was a special mold that she got somewhere along the way that you would bake the two halves, and when you assembled them and frosted it, it looked exactly like a little lamb sitting on the center of the dining room table. It was white frosting on the outside with coconut to give it a little texture and a couple of raisins for eyes and a red ribbon around the neck and a little bell on the ribbon. And all around the lamb, little green boughs of pine branches or whatever. And it was a beautiful thing. It's presided over the, not just the Christmas dinner, but she made it early in Advent or before sometimes, and it watched over the comings and goings of our family all through the Advent season, the Christmas, New Year's, and on into January. We never ate it. It wasn't designed for, well, one year we tried to eat it, and we cut into it, and the frosting had turned to plaster and just turned to dust, and the cake itself was a heap of stale crumbs when we got the knife into it. But it wasn't designed to be eaten. It was a centerpiece. And it seems to me that that lamb cake is a pretty good picture or metaphor for the relationship that my family had and most of the people that I knew in church had with Jesus. He was the centerpiece. And he kind of presided over the special events in life. He you know, marriages and births and deaths and graduations and so forth. We honored him. We spoke about him. He was in the center of everything. But that's as far as it got. We never ate him, so to speak. He was at arm's length. And it wasn't for a great number of years that I found out that you could go farther than that. But, you know, ironically, if we had listened to the words that he spoke when he was here on earth, we would have realized that that was a tragic error to leave him as a centerpiece, a very honored centerpiece, up on a pedestal, so to speak, but leave him at arm's length and not consume him and not incorporate him into who we were. Because Jesus quite plainly said that that was not enough. He came to earth and he got people's attention by feeding them bread, miraculously, but it was bread. And when they wanted more of it, he said to them, well, don't arrange your life around the pursuit of that kind of bread, but rather seek after or work for or ingest the kind of bread that lives on inside you and satisfies not your stomach's hunger, but your soul's hunger. He said he was the bread of life. And when they, you know, wanted to know how do you get that bread, he said, well, you have to be given to the bread by God. And the way that happens is to be drawn by God to him, by as you listen to God and learn from God. And he, much the same as if you were here last week, we talked about how do you get inside the bake shop to get to the bread, and the baker opens the door and calls you in and takes you over to the table where the bread is. And so now you're close to the bread, but that's not enough. Being close is not enough. And so Jesus continues on. And let's read it together. Verse 48. He said, I am the bread of life. Now, your forefathers ate manna in the desert, and yet they died. But here, and he was, you know, gesturing to himself, here is the bread that comes down from heaven, which a man may eat and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. This bread is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world. And then the Jews began to argue sharply among themselves. How can this man give us his flesh to eat? And Jesus said to them, I tell you the truth. Unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. For my flesh is real food, and my blood is real drink. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood remains in me, and I in him. Just as the living Father sent me, and I live because of the Father, so the one who feeds on me will live because of me. This is the bread that came down from heaven. Again, your forefathers ate manna and died, but he who feeds on this bread will live forever. And that's what he taught them in the synagogue in Capernaum. Now, it seems to me that Jesus, in the very first couple, three verses of this passage, is teaching three rather important points to be understood about this tough subject about eating his flesh and drinking his blood. It's without a doubt that these are rough sayings of Jesus. They're intended to be rough sayings of Jesus, as we'll see in a moment why he did it this way. But he starts off by saying to a people that had been saying to him, hey, if you're the Messiah, if you're the one that Moses said would come and be like Moses, why don't you do that trick that Moses did and give us some manna? Because we've been taught that when the fulfillment of the Moses prophecy that another prophet would come like him, when he shows up, he's going to identify himself by giving us manna to eat. And Jesus' response to them could have been, well, I did that yesterday, and you didn't get it. But what he says is, look, even if I did that, it wouldn't do you any good, because the people that ate the manna that Moses gave them, they're all dead. And what I've come to give you is the bread that allows you to live forever. My bread, myself as bread of life, is better than manna. And he's teaching them that the bread of life is not a nice luxury to have. It's an absolute necessity for spiritual life. Without it, you'll die. You know, it strikes me that the people that ate the manna didn't get the full benefit of the manna either. I mean, you ask, well, why did God set it up so they had to feed him in the wilderness? He could have set it up that they would have had time to bake and take things with them, and they brought treasure from Egypt. Why not load up a couple of wagons full of food? And it's not that far across the desert. He could have easily arranged for them to be prepared to take food across the desert, and it would have been no problem. But he arranged for them to go into the desert in such a way that they had no food, and within a couple of days' time, they would be crying out to be rescued. And then he could give them the manna, not so that they would have something to eat, although that was one part of it, but primarily what he was doing was teaching the people of Israel to trust him, that he could be trusted every single day for the most basic necessities of physical life and beyond that. And they ate the manna, but they didn't get the point. And they didn't trust, and they didn't make it into the promised land. Well, Jesus is having the same problem with people. You know, he's doing miracles, he's feeding them, he's healing and so forth. And they're believing in his name, it says in chapter 2, but he doesn't entrust himself to them. They haven't got the full kind of belief that's necessary. And they don't get the point of the miracles. They treat healings like some substitute for a Band-Aid. When in reality, these miracles that Jesus has been doing are primarily for the purpose of revealing who he is and instilling a sense of trust in the people so that they will put their faith in him. That's what a miracle is for. Back in the early 70s, I had rejected God. I was a proud atheist or agnostic, depending on which day it was. And you know, I rejected all the things I've been taught as a kid because I realized that my folks didn't really believe them. And I was searching in my own wisdom through all kinds of various chemical substances and Eastern religions and philosophies and all kinds of stuff. And I figured, well, what I'll do is when I can, you know, when it fits my, when it rings my chimes, so to speak, when it resonates with me, then I'll believe that. And so I was picking and choosing from all these different things, and I had it all figured out that I was in control of who God was. That is, until Anne Marie came home one day from the People's Clinic and announced that she had something growing inside her that would kill her unless they removed it. And then life stopped. And then I found myself praying to the God I did not believe in, asking Him to take care of it, because we didn't have any insurance or any means to be able to have surgery or any of that kind of thing. And 2 weeks later, she went back to the doctor and they told her that it was gone. Now that miracle was God drawing me to Him, but I didn't get it. I said, thanks, and went on my merry agnostic way. When the purpose of that was completely missed by me, was to discover that I could trust God. It's absolutely dangerous to treat Jesus as a centerpiece and to kind of, you know, celebrate around Him and keep Him at arm's length, a nice, pretty thing in the middle of the table. He's an absolute necessity for life. And even if you are the recipient of some of the miraculous things that He does in your life, that's not enough. He goes on to say that you will get no benefit from the bread of life unless you eat it. Do you ever say, oh, that dessert looks way too beautiful to eat? Not me. I've never seen a dessert that looked too good to eat. But some I've heard people say that, and that's, you know, why was it that we didn't eat that lamb? And Jesus said, it's not enough to leave me as a centerpiece. You must eat me. He says in verse 50, here, and he's pointing to himself, is the bread which a man may eat and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. If anyone eats this bread, he will live forever. Now, he started to threaten the people with kind of a disconnect. He's talking about them eating him. Now, obviously, he's talking in metaphorical terms. And incidentally, he's not talking about taking communion. Not talking about that. He's talking about, in a metaphorical way, eating who he is. And if you start to think about what eating is, it's revealed as a perfect metaphor for faith. Because Jesus is talking about a certain kind of faith. How do we know? Because verse 47 says, I tell you the truth, he who believes has everlasting life. And verse 51 says, anyone eats this bread, he'll live forever. Or verse 54 says, whoever eats has eternal life. So eats is a metaphor that Jesus is using to describe a particular kind of belief, because there is a kind of belief that doesn't do any good. And that's the kind of belief that causes the people to follow him across the lake and come back and rally around and ask him for more bread and say, we believe in your name and all this kind of stuff, but it's not enough. He says, you got to eat me. Well, if you start thinking about what eating is, it's a great metaphor for what Jesus is talking about. You pick up an apple to eat it, and you bite into it. Is that eating? No. Your teeth come together and you begin to chew it, and you mash it all up in your mouth, and the saliva starts to work on. Is that eating? Not yet. When we were kids, there was this particularly foul kind of rice pudding that somebody in our family would make, and they'd serve it, and we wouldn't eat it, but we would pretend to eat it. We'd bite into it and chew it up. And my sister was busted once for and feeding it to the dog under the table. But it is not eating until you do what? Swallow. Now, dig this. Swallow in English is a metaphor for believe, isn't it? Oh, he told me he was going to do that, and I swallowed it. Right? Or I swallowed that hook, line, and sinker. Right? It's not until you swallow that you have eating. Tasting Jesus is not enough. Chewing on Jesus is not enough. Swallowing him is what he's talking about. Well, what's swallowing? Well, swallowing is a, first of all, it's a personal act, isn't it? You cannot swallow as a group. You could all go together and you say, well, let's go out to dinner and go to a pig roast or something. And when you get there, say, well, let's eat that pig. But when it comes down to actually swallowing, that's your decision personally. You can't do it as a group. So it's a personal decision. It's a voluntary act, right? And it's a voluntary act that's based on trust. Because you ordinarily will not swallow something unless you believe it's good for you, like the rice pudding. But if you think it's going to do you some kind of good, then you will swallow it. So swallowing is a voluntary, personal act based on trust in which you take something that exists outside of you and incorporate it to become part of you. A perfect metaphor for what Jesus is talking about. He says the bread of life will do you absolutely no good unless you swallow it. Well, he's given people the heebie-jeebies because he's talking in a metaphorical term that kind of rattles him a little bit. And if he leaves it here, he's kind of intrigued them and he said some you know, nice, challenging religious stuff. But if he leaves it there, my belief is that you and I would never have heard of Jesus. He goes and he ramps up the radical nature of what he's saying until he really threatens them. Not, you know, I'm going to get you kind of threatens them, but threatens their sense of how reality works. He goes and he says in verse 51, this bread, the second part of 51, this bread is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world. Now, a fight breaks out. See that in 52? It says in the NIV, they've sweetened it up a little bit. They argued sharply. The word in the original language means to have a fist fight. Why are they fighting? Because they're afraid. That's why people fight. They're threatened. They feel like they're about to lose something, so it's either fight or you know, fight or flight kind of thing, and a fight breaks out. Before they were muttering about what he was saying, now he's really got them. And if you read a little bit beyond where we're going today, you'll see that they leave in droves. He just keeps ramping it up and ramping it up and ramping it up because it's an approximate sort of almost understanding of what he's saying is not enough. You have to swallow him or you don't get any benefit. And he says, all right, now it's my flesh that I'm talking about. And when he says that, now he's really got him. Because flesh is not a word that a religious teacher would have said out loud. It's not cursing, really, but it was a crude kind of word. It's a basic. You know, one day we're coming home from church and Anne-Marie says, dear, did you really mean to say scumbag in the sermon? And I had to admit, no, I didn't really mean to say it. It just kind of slipped out. But Jesus meant to say flesh. And it hit him with the same, who? He said flesh. And he said, I'm talking about my flesh. Well, what's he talking about? He's opening up a hint to them that they couldn't have possibly really understood, but with 20/20 hindsight, we can understand. And basically, the idea of this, he said, look, this is bread to eat. It's not bread as a centerpiece. It's an absolute necessity for life, and you won't get any benefit from it unless you eat it. But before you can eat bread, it must be broken. And I am going to give my very flesh broken to allow you to eat this bread. He said, my flesh I will give for the life of the world. Slow down and look at this. He said, I will give it. He's talking about something that's going to happen in the future, which we now know is the crucifixion. I will give. It's going to be a voluntary offering on his part. It's not going to be taken from him, his life. He's going to give it. And it's for the life of the world. Not the life of the nation of Israel. Not the life of my people, but the life of anyone in this world who comes to the place where he's able to swallow the bread of life. To take him from the outside to the inside. See that? He's talking about the crucifixion. It's absolutely necessary that Jesus die on the cross, or none of us would be able to appropriate this life. That's to balance justice. Justice, well, that's redundant. Justice is balanced. We have a system in this country we call the justice system, but it really is not just. You know, you sentence somebody to 15 years for taking another person's life, that's not justice. And then you let them out in 7.5 years, that's even less justice. Justice demands that the punishment fully balance the consequence of the crime. And we talked about it this last week. The crime of sin acted out, the power of sin in each of our lives acted out. What that does is it makes it impossible for God's Spirit to live in our souls. And so, spiritually speaking, we're absolutely dead. We cannot operate as we should. We're dead. We cannot commune with God the way we're designed to commune. And so the punishment for that, the penalty for that, is death. Not a symbolic death of an innocent animal, but a human death, which obviously God could not require of us and still cause us to live forever. There'd be kind of a contradiction in terms. And so he says, because I love you so much, I'll send my son. And he'll live a perfect life, and he'll die on the cross in your place, and justice will be satisfied. So that I, with love and with grace, can offer you this bread of life, and you can have my life in you. The bread of life is no centerpiece. It's real bread to be eaten. And it does no good, just like any other kind of bread, unless you do swallow it. Take it from the outside, inside. An act of personal surrender and trust. And to make that possible, first the bread must be broken. Well, how's that work? You got these people fighting over this. How is he going to give us this flesh to eat and so forth? What's all this really mean? And he goes deeper and he says, look, in verse 53, he says, I'm telling you the truth about this. Unless you do this. And he ramps it up again. He says, blood this time. You drink my blood. And that's even more offensive because to a Jew, the blood represented life. It belonged to God. You know, it was offensive to even ingest any kind of blood. And he says, but unless you do this, you don't have any life in you. Now notice he's not saying, unless you do this, I'm going to take the life away from you. He's saying, you already do not have any life in you. Your body works, your mind and your soul works, but you don't have any life. Remember we talked last week, we illustrated it with a cell phone. The cell phone's got the case and the buttons and all for the hardware, the body, and it's got the software, which is kind of like the soul inside there. But unless it has the signal, it's dead. You cannot use it for its intended purpose unless it has a connection to the signal. And Jesus says, unless you eat this bread of life, unless you take it on the inside, you just don't have any signal. If your cell phone won't connect to the signal because of a software problem, and I give you a compact disc with a patch on it, You cannot just take this compact disc and wave it around the phone and underneath the phone and over the phone like that and fix it. It won't work. The phone will be dead. What you have to do is take the software from the disc and load it into the phone. Then it'll work. And Jesus says, unless you take my life in you by swallowing, you don't have any life. That's why all this is necessary. And then he says in verse 56, whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood remains in me and I in him. And the word remains lives in me. He dwells in me. He makes his home in me. And I make my home in him. That's how it works. And then he illustrates that. He says, just the same way as the Father's life is alive in me, and everything that I do is based on his life in me, that's how you're supposed to live, with my life in you. You see that? It's important that we see that. In verse 57, just as the living Father sent me, and I live because of the Father, so the one who feeds on me will live because of me. You know, Jesus said, even the words that I say to you are not my own. It's the Father who lives in me who's doing his work. And he says to us later on, he says, you can't do anything unless I'm living in you. You know, I'm the vine, you're the branches kind of thing. He said, this is what you need to do. You need to swallow. You need to take the bread of life from the outside and by a personal act of trust, take it from the outside to the inside where I will live. And power you up and connect you to the signal so that your life will be powerful and joyous. And how do we know joyous? Well, he switched the verb for eat in this section of the passage. We don't see it so much in English. They changed it from eat to feeds on. But it's gone from a one-time swallowing word, which is an ordinary word for eat, and he's changed it to kind of a slang expression that's a continuous expression for what? Chomping down on potato chips. It's the word for munch and crunch. Really, square business. The person that munches and crunches on me throughout his life goes through life in a joyous and powerful way is the effect of what he's saying. When we were in India, a missionary over there warned us not to give money to the beggars, which seemed kind of hard, you know, and because they were very sad-looking people, and they had nothing, and we had everything comparatively. But he said, no, if you give them money, they will only have to give that money entirely to the mobster who controls them. And he pointed to some of the mansions around the town that were owned by the mob bosses who controlled the beggars. And the beggars go out there and they take the money and they give it to the mob, and the mob gives them little bit less than what they really need to live on, food-wise, so they continue to look pathetic and starving, so they raise more money for these guys for their mansions. That's an awful thing. But we're stuck in traffic one day, and here comes this guy on crutches, and he's got one leg, I presume from polio, is kind of sticking up at a weird angle, and he's hopping along on the other leg in the crutches, it's like a parking lot. There's an intersection with five roads leading in, and I don't know, maybe 500 or 600 cars stuck in this one intersection, all honking their horns and sitting there. And here comes this guy. He comes up to our car, and he holds his hand out. And my heart was just ripped out. I said, Tim, can't we do anything to help this man? And he says, well, if we've got some food, we can give it to him because then he can eat it and then he won't have to give it away. And so we looked, and Heidi had fixed us some coffee cake that morning. And we handed the coffee cake out the window to this man. And he just grabbed a handful of that cake and wolfed it right down. He swallowed it whole. And then he began to munch and crunch on the rest. And he was hopping away through the crowd and through the traffic. And every once in a while, he'd turn around and his face would break out into this just angelic smile. And his eyes were twinkling, and he'd stop, and he'd take another handful of his cake, and he'd wave to us, and he'd pop it in his mouth and munch and crunch on it and go off and turn around and wave to us again. Thank you, thank you. And there's a picture there of what Jesus is saying. We live in a distorted world, and we're crippled in it. And we're dying. And he is the bread of life. But it's not enough to just gather around the bread of life. There comes a moment for each and every single person where he must trust enough in the bread of life to swallow it, to take Jesus from the outside and incorporate him to become our life on the inside. Without him on the inside, we have no life, no signal. And Jesus allowed his body to be crucified on the cross, broken, so that we could eat him. Talking about him, celebrating him, doing stuff in his name, it's not enough. You have to eat him. But when you do, he lives in you, powers up your life. And as you munch and crunch on his life joyously and hop through life, still crippled, headed towards glory, waving your worship and thanks, it changes life so that it's truly alive. And he becomes our life on the inside, because he's the bread of life.